Welcome to Dr. Fred Bell's Health, Science, and Energy Show, live from somewhere up in the mountain, from Jurassic Park, the name of our place up here. And we're going to have our little bit of music intro while Steve gets his hat on. Band Voyager, we're a crazy bunch. Tonight we have on our sidekicks Bella Bird. Hello, Bella. She's right there. And we have Steve Barish. Steve, what's been going on all week?
Well, I've just been massaging like crazy. I did about 35 massages this week, so it's been really crazy for me.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got a flying saucer. If you had your video on, you'd see there's a flying saucer hovering around over my head here.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been getting wild and crazy out here in the Jurassic Park area. You know,
yeah.
I should call it Jurassic Space Park. Would be a better deal, I think. Get out of here, flying saucer. Go away. Scram. That thing is just all over the place. So you're having a nice evening tonight? Well, tell me about the experiences that you've had this week.
Well, I've been using the projector a lot, you know, the platinum projector.
Right.
And I'm doing a lot of work with that, and I forgot to mention something. When we were out in California, people were rubbing against me with that platinum projector on.
Yeah.
And they were actually getting electric shocks.
Oh, yeah.
But not a bad shock. What it would do, it would balance them out instantaneously. So I think the platinum projector is a lot more powerful than what we think it is, Fred.
Well, we're just learning about it. You know, it's one of those devices that we invent that we figure out what it's going to do as we destroy ourselves in a nice way with it and get higher in a kite and do all that. I'm going to have a little shawootsie right now while we...
Oh, cool.
You've got your bottle of shawootsie there, too?
Oh, yeah.
So you ought to have a little shot. The show goes really well with shawootsie.
Yes, it does.
So anyway, we had a real interesting week. I don't know if he's listening tonight. I hope he is. But back when I was in high school, I had in junior high school, I had a good friend named Steven Eberbaugh.
Mm-hmm.
And he had built an oscilloscope. Now, we're talking 50s here, 1950s, or mid-50s. We built an oscilloscope, and he did, actually. And we built some equipment that would monitor your brainwave frequencies, and we could hook our electrodes up to the occipital parietal lobes, and we would, hypnotize ourselves and do, post-hypnotic trance work and all that kind of stuff. He also invented one of the first transistor radios in the world, which we took into a drugstore where we used to go have our cherry Cokes and chocolate root beers and blew the whole store out. And we did all kinds of inventing together, We were so far ahead of the time, it was ridiculous. And so after 40-some years, we reconnected earlier this week.
Mm-hmm.
And so now he's going to be working on the X1 project.
Oh, how great.
Yeah. He went on, he worked for Wernher von Braun down in Africa. You know, we had to catch up on 45 years. Of, He started a company, I forget the name of it, MDX or something, speakers company, which Bose. You've heard of Bose people stole a lot of his technology. He had patents on it. So he invented the one-speaker surround sound system. And he went to MIT, graduated from there. And so he's had almost a parallel life. So now the two of us are together again. And watch out what we do now. We might take this planet for a ride.
That would be interesting.
Yeah, between the two of us, we come up with ideas that either one of us aren't even capable of.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's pretty cool, huh?
I'd say so.
Yeah, he's back in Ann Arbor where we started out. I'm from Ann Arbor. He's from Ann Arbor.
Right. It's got to be beautiful weather out there now. Boy, when I was out in California, it was 39 degrees. That was really cool.
That was just downtown.
Yeah.
The weather beautiful. It was most of the time it was warm out here.
Yeah.
It's probably, I don't know, probably around 70 or so right now.
Well, you're actually below L.A., aren't you? I don't know how far below you are, but...
Yeah, we're in Jurassic Park.
Right.
Space Park.
Well, you're what, about an hour below L.A.?
Yeah, well, the other night driving back from LAX, it took me an hour and a half.
Did it really?
Yeah, but that's about what it is. About an hour. Well, it actually took about an hour and 15 minutes.
Right.
And the map says an hour and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow.
So how's your master crystal working?
The master crystal is really firing away pretty good. It's... I'm having a lot of fun with everything that I have, but the master crystal is a very special object. It fires really, really well. It's just it thinks, Fred.
Yeah. I wanted to welcome all our new Ustream listeners. We've got quite a large number of Ustream listeners that watch the show now. That we're independent of BBS.
Right.
Show my alien self here for a second.
Huh.
I could turn into an alien. With this new camera that I've got here, it converts me. I can even put on sunglasses. But I don't see the sunglasses going on right now, but I've done it. So anyway, explain what master crystals do a little bit.
Well, my master crystal, what I've seen so far is that it actually throws light out. It beams of light that are going to different parts of the body. So when I'm working... When I'm working on top of somebody, in other words, if I'm doing their shoulders, I actually can see under the table and watch the lights of the great master crystal actually go right into the chakras. So it's a beautiful light. It's a very bright white light, and sometimes it'll be a little yellow. I haven't seen blue, but those colors will go into the chakra that might be a little weaker or an area that might be weaker. And it really works well. It thinks all by itself, Fred.
Yeah, they do that. It's hard to explain that to people until you actually experience one.
You had a fight with me to buy that damn thing.
Yeah, I had a fight with you to get you to come out to California, too.
I know.
But
the Master Crystal, when it starts really, really firing, it gives off a wonderful vibration.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I'd love to buy a bigger one, but I have no idea where I'd put it.
Yeah, you need to get one of those great big giant ones before there's only two of those left in the whole world.
Really?
Yeah, they're over in Laguna Beach, and if you don't get one of those fairly soon, those great big ones, which then that makes the converts the one you've got into an amplifier. They won't be around anymore.
Really?
Yeah. You can pretty much count on that.
Well, they're fantastic. If somebody needs a master crystal, now's the time to buy those things, because it's something that I wouldn't give up. I would if somebody offered me $6,000 to $8,000 or whatever the case may, I wouldn't sell this crystal.
No, you'd be silly to, because it would cost, you couldn't replace it now.
Yeah, first of all, I wouldn't want to replace it. It's part of me.
Yeah.
You know, they really grow, and they have a tremendous amount of compassion.
Yeah.
Tremendous amount of compassion. You can tell by the way that it fires, and it's amazing how it figures the body out, or the person that I'm working on, because nobody's ever gotten an overload from the crystal. It just fires it very gently.
Yeah, well, down in Arkansas, when you go down there to buy crystals along around Lake Ouachita,
mm-hmm.
What happens is you can walk into a store and they'll probably have a master crystal that they applied, got there 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But you go over there to it and it'll be the biggest thing in there in a single point, because all the others have been sold everywhere. But you go over there and ask them to buy, to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
They aren't going to do it. They just absolutely won't sell it, because they know what they do. They don't know how they work,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
but they do work.
Yeah, it's an amazing tool. It's just part of me. I love working with it.
Yeah.
It's just tremendous. As a matter of fact, sometimes I'll sit down and I'll meditate in my room, and I'll put my hands around the crystal and just feel the vibration of it going through me.
Yeah.
And it's really wonderful. You know, you're so lucky to have found what these master crystals can do. And I can see what they do, but it's just amazing how they really work. I'm extremely lucky that I can see what I can see, but they're just so beautiful to watch.
I know, that's the beauty of them, you know.
You know, I don't know what a bigger crystal can do. I have no idea, but you know what I've done is put my other crystals around the master crystal. And it clears the other crystals out.
Yeah.
So instead of using salt or water or sunlight or whatever, I just put them around the master crystal and clears everything.
Yeah, you know, I was lucky. You know, that Coleman mine has quite a history. It was actually owned by the Japanese at one point, just previous to World War II, and then they let it go, and I forget what company had it, but Ron Coleman's grandfather leased it, I think, from Weyerhaeuser or somebody, Canadian company. And we were able to mine about 5,000 crystals out of there. And I remember back about mid-'80s, actually it was the mid-'80s or early 90s, Ron told me there wouldn't be, you know, very many left because the darn mine was filling up with water. It's the only mine in the world that put a large single point out. And, you know, that we could use for a master crystal. And, of course, the big points that come from South America aren't polarized in the ground properly, so the electron spin, the quantum levels are different than the South American crystals. They're a lot less expensive, but the South American crystals only are psychic amplifiers because of the rotational spin of the quantum fields that are on them.
Right.
This particular mine in Arkansas.
Right.
Other single points up here in different mines around North America, but they're tiny little things. There's nothing bigger than 4, 5, 6 pounds. Something like 40 pounds to make it into a master crystal.
Wasn't there a master crystal that are very, very rare? I think it's, you had talked about that to me the other week, and I was surprised at the value of those things. I think they're 3 or 4 times worth what a regular master crystal.
Oh, you're talking about the Mac Earls.
That's the one.
Yeah, I've got a $40,000 35-pound Mac Earl here if somebody wants it. And at $40,000, that's cheaper, one of those. There was only 6,000 pounds of that material ever found. And what happened was it was underground at Jimmy Coleman's mine, Ron's brother. And that was just a mine that they were pulling crystal out of to chop up to make transistors out of and integrated circuits. So they accidentally, when they were digging down in there, it's like an open hole quarry. So they hit a cave on the edge. In the cave, they found this mud, which typically those Arkansas caves have a lot of anyway. And these crystals had turned 180 degrees underground over a million years, which they normally would get crushed, and you'd find little shards when that happened.
Right,
these were all intact. And then they went upside down. The whole pocket went upside down.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So they picked them off the ceiling of the cave, the top of it. And so some of the clusters that weighed 40, 50 pounds, instead of having normal points, they looked like flowers. They just came out and curved way out around it.
Very thin,
and just like crystals. You know what I mean? Like chandeliers are beautiful, but like if you take a straw, you know, and flatten it, and then put a knife to it, and then peel it up the side, it'll curl over.
Wow.
Kind of gets a curl going to it, and that's what these crystals are. These 50, 40 pounders go for $75 to $250,000.
Wow, that's incredible.
Little 40 pounders, and that's the clusters. So they're in the Smithsonian. And then we got a bunch of pieces that there's none for sale anymore, but I bought some off of collectors. I've got some single points that run anywhere from $500 to $6,000 for half a pounder, which is pretty good size. And we use them for healing. And the first time I ever saw one of those things work, One thing that Ron pointed out was that when you hold one of these crystals up to a, they're perfectly clear, first of all. They're clear from the very base to the very tip. There's nothing there but clarity.
Mm-hmm.
No whiteness anywhere. They're like glass, even though they're huge. Even the clusters were that way. And that's unheard of. And when you shine a quartz halogen light on it, you'll see these beautiful purple feathers inside, which are oxygen pockets trapped in the crystal, you know, millions of years old.
Mm-hmm.
The only crystal in the world that you can put up to a very bright light like that and see these little feathers, these blue feathers in them. That right away established a precedent.
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, I had a friend of mine that got into a very serious car wreck. He was going to die. He was at Cedars of Sinai Hospital. Every bone in his body was broken, and they couldn't even put him in a cast. They just had him on a bed with all kinds of little clamps holding his body back into the shape that it was supposed to be in. And so Dr. Cooper up there, one of the medical doctors in the emergency room, called me after that Don had been in there for about a day or two and said, Dr. Bell, he says, your friend Don is up here, and we don't think we're going to be able to save him. But I know you're his holistic doctor, his naturopath. Maybe you got something in your bag of tricks, because we really think he's a cool guy, but of course he didn't talk to him. You know, he was out. So I went up there, and I took a Mac Earl with me, one of the healing points, about a half a pounder, and one pyramid, you know, one pyridome. That's all I took. And I went up there, and he was, of course, unconscious and had brain consciousness and hadn't been conscious for a week or 3 or 4 days, so I put all that stuff under the table and explained to Dr. Cooper, just leave it there, and that's all we could do.
Mm-hmm.
And so about 2 weeks later, the phone rings, and he's on the phone. Don's on the phone, and he's, you know, it's like, oh, Brad, how you doing? You could hardly hear him. The bottom line is he was on the phone, and he was alive, and he survived. And ever since then, Cedars Sinai Hospital up in Los Angeles there, very famous hospital, thinks the world of Pyridine products, including the mackerel crystal. And that was the first time I'd ever seen one of those puppies work. And Don was the crazy kind of guy, you know, as soon as he got the tubes out of his mouth, you know, and as soon as he functioned again, where he could sit up, you know, which took another 2 months, first thing he asked for was a McDonald's hamburger and a beer. You know, they had to smuggle those in. That was really funny. And so anyway, I really got to see the Mac Earl crystal work.
Yeah, yeah.
So we have a point. We have a single point that came from a collection, a private collection of Jimmy Coleman.
Right.
It weighs about 35, 37 pounds. It's probably one of the largest single point of Mac Earl's ever mined out of the mine, if not the largest one.
Right.
Got an asking price of $40,000 on it.
Yeah.
I was hoping you could see it.
I'd love to see it. I'd love to feel what it feels like.
Yeah.
I'd love to see it.
No, what I'll do if I remember next week.
Pardon?
You get what? Are you gonna get a computer pretty soon?
I hope so, Fred. I bought an Apple. I have had nothing but trouble with this damn thing.
Yeah, why don't you take it back?
I would love to, but I think maybe my brother's kids need a computer, so I'll give them. I got to go buy something a little bit different because this thing is really it's impossible for me to use.
Yeah, well, if you get one of these Sony Vios like I use, there's several. They got newer ones. I've got two fairly new ones here. They have a camera built in, and all you have to do is hook up to Ustream and click on Ustream, and boom, you're on the air.
Yeah, I've had nothing but trouble with this. We were talking with each other, I think, about a few months ago, and I was using it, and then after that, I haven't had any luck at all.
Yeah.
And I've had people come in here and try to get it to work, and it won't work. So,
well, anyway, what I'm doing tonight, as I have been, I'm reading some of the inside track, seeing it's coming along. I've had enough interruptions, as usual, but it's coming along. And so I'm going to read some of it tonight, and we'll discuss it. This is a section about, it's the beginning. You know, the book is in basic three sections, or four sections. One, it's the history of all of science, from Thales through Einstein and Tesla, up to the present time with the latest coolest scientists like Michio Kaku, who I'm hoping will write a small a bit for the book. It also covers the mind control since the beginning of World War II and up to the present, and how it's the governments have secretly injected drugs, and the drug companies have been partnered to this, to hypnotize and put angel dust in all of the people. And then the third section, which I haven't started on yet, which is the three main sections, is about the satellite electronic harassment manipulation that takes place to cause the drugs to be, you know, to cause you to want to have the drugs and program your head. And, of course, then the book goes into the solutions to the problems. And, of course, after that, we go into the latest interesting string theory and the latest thing on quantum tunneling and quantum mechanics and quantum entanglement. So it really covers, and the hologram itself, the universe, as a hologram. And, of course, we cover cosmology, too, which is a side thing. So that's, you know, maybe three major parts and three or four minor parts of the book. So tonight what we're going to do is I'm going to read some of the presentation that I did a couple of weeks ago when you were out here.
Yeah.
And this chapter, none of these chapters have real names yet, but we just call this drugs, drug companies, health, manipulation, deception, power, and mind control. It's just like when you make a movie, you have different chapters of the film, and then you eventually put it together and give it a title. Okay, the earliest drug stores date back to the Middle Ages. The first known drug store was opened by Arabian pharmacists in Baghdad in 754. Isn't that funny how Iraq is always the center of everything? Soon, many more began operating throughout the medieval Islamic world and eventually moved to medieval Europe by the 19th century. Many of the drug stores in Europe eventually developed into large pharmaceutical companies. Mm-hmm. Now, most of today's major pharmaceutical companies were founded in the late 19th and 20th centuries. Key discoveries were made in the 1920s and 30s, such as insulin, penicillin, and then became mass manufactured. Switzerland, Germany, and Italy were the most recognized manufactured, followed by the United Kingdom, U.S., Belgium, and the Netherlands. That's how it starts out. And the homeopathic world that I live in, and the allopathic world, which I don't live in, split around the time that Louis Pasteur, and he lived from December 27 to 1822 to September 28, 1895, discovered penicillin, which was a pharmaceutical, and then Samuel Hahnemann, April 10th in Aries, 1755 to July 2nd, 1843, popularized natural remedies. Legislation was acted upon to test and approve drugs to require appropriate labeling. Prescription and non-prescription drugs became legally distinguished from one another as the pharmaceutical industry matured. The industry got underway in earnest about in the 1950s in the development of systematic scientific approaches, understanding human biology, and sophisticated manufacturing techniques. Numerous new drugs were developed during the 1950s and mass-produced and marketed throughout the 1960s. These include the first oral contraceptive called the pill. You remember the girl when you were younger, and she says, you'd say, "Are you on the pill?" Remember that? Did you ever try that?
Nope.
Okay, so you never had a girl tell you she was on the pill?
No.
Did you go out when you were younger?
Not really, Fred. I didn't really date until I was about 18, 19 years old.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't really either, but I'm just a little older than you.
No, I think you're actually younger than me.
No, you're not my age.
Yes, I am. I was born in 42.
Oh, yeah, I guess you're right. You look like a little punk kid.
Yeah.
So we look like punk kids.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
We look very young.
Okay, so anyhow, called the pill. Cortisone, blood pressure drugs, and other heart medications, MAO inhibitors, which is monoamino oxidase, I should put that in there like that, SSRI, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, drugs, and finally Thorazine, Haldol, and other tranquilizers brought upon the age of psychiatric medication. Valium, which was diazepam, discovered in 1960, was marketed from 1963 and became the most rapidly enlarged prescribed drug in history.
Mm-hmm.
I first became aware of mind control when I joined the U.S. Air Force in 1959 and participated in special training programs.
Mm-hmm.
By 1960, I was stationed at the 776th Aero Squadron at Point Arena Air Force Base, located in Northern California.
Mm.
Yeah, our jobs there were to protect the western part of the United States from any form of attack. By the way, that lady that was one of the ladies that worked was at the booth, you know?
Yes.
You remember the lady that was from the Air Force?
Yes.
She worked at the same time I did at Beale Air Force Base, and she was in the same command that I was in.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
Amazing.
Yeah. Our jobs were to protect the western part of the United States from any form of attack. This was during the height of the Cold War, so that our position was considered instrumental in the national global defense. I've been editing this a little better. I haven't had too many mistakes so far. Our equipment, early warning radar, mainly consisted of an ANFPS-35 search set that looked out over the ocean 400 miles, and an ANFPS-28 height set that looked at how high an object was.
Mm-hmm.
This information was then fed over the Strategic Air Command, SAC headquarters, located at Beale Air Force Base in Northern California. And by the way, they're still up there, and there's still a SAC base.
Hmm.
She was even at Hamilton Air Force Base there in Novato, north of Santa Rosa.
Yeah.
Same time I was. And I used to ride my old black Harley in there. She probably saw me, this lady.
Geez, I wonder if she saw you. Yeah, that would be very interesting.
There's not too many people. You know, we both went to Keesler Air Force Base, and we were in the same barracks down there. Over there was called the White Triangle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So funny. I mean, it's funny to have somebody come and work at you. Well, she'd actually worked the booth. She was a guest of the lady that did work it.
Hmm.
You know? So anyway, we had an FBNS 28 height set that looked at how high an object was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The information was then fed over the Strategic Air Command headquarters located at Beale in Northern California. If we sensed a threat, we would send out interceptor aircraft to check it out. One of the first things I noticed that was very often late at night, we would observe objects descending from outer space vertically at a rate of 20,000 miles an hour and at an approximate altitude of 5,000 feet, turning, then taking a horizontal path in the direction of Mexico at about 5,000 miles an hour.
Wow.
Yeah, these observations were made on a planned position indicator, PPI scope, and the operator, was nicknamed the Scope Dope.
Mm-hmm.
Fill out a classified government form, DDS Form 332, detailing the events.
Mm-hmm.
The PPI room was small with several operators, all possessing above top secret clearances. As soon as they left the room, they handed the forms to a senior tech sergeant whom often shredded the reports. This to me was a little over the top, as all this work was paid for by U.S. taxpayers, and they were never notified, and most of the information was destroyed.
Wow.
So here I am sitting there, and this is the beginning of the outer fringes of what this book is leading into in this section, of me not quite understanding why you spend all this money, fill out all these reports, and throw them away in the morning, every single night. I don't know, a shot of shavuotsi there. It really helps me read. It helps me focus. Okay. Soon it was obviously... some of it obviously was kept in file somewhere, but due to the overwhelming rapidity of these observations, the reports were status quo. And it's so tied into Roswell, you know, because Roswell was such a big cover-up, which I learned about it later when I was working over at NASA by people that were covering it up.
Mm-hmm.
But having had my own personal experience at this Air Force station, I knew how the government, well, I was learning how the government works. You know, people really, unless you've really been working for the government on top secret classified stealth projects, you really don't know how the government works.
Mm-hmm.
They consider civilians, you know, outsiders, to be worthless, just things that get in the way. Just so you know.
Well,
but when I complained about this to the base commander, I was told in no uncertain terms, that was Colonel Harry Bunning, I thought I'd put his name in there, just I didn't. No one terms to absolutely forget what I saw. Those that would not heed these specific commands often would find themselves institutionalized at Letterman General Hospital, an army base located in the Presidio of San Francisco. Can't believe I didn't put Harry's name in there. I make a note of that. I'm always, I like to put everybody's name in there. What we're really doing in this, what we're really doing here is, this is a very factual book with even the time, the birth signs of the people involved, pretty much everyone, completely documented, every single government declassified program is mentioned by its classification number. It's very accurate because it's so bizarre nobody would believe it, but they can go and check out any section of it and find the truth to be real. You know what I mean? That's, I write every single word has to be looked at, every single word, so that there's no challenge. I mean, it can be challenges, but there's no defeat in any form of challenge.
Right.
That's how I write now. When I left the Air Force and went to work for North American Aviation, later known as Rockwell, and I was assigned to NASA work on the Saturn spacecraft, I found myself working for several scientists and their assistants. That were formerly part of the Nazi Third Reich and had been brought over to America at the end of World War II under Operation Paperclip. Now, and I won't get to this tonight, but maybe next week, Operation Paperclip, I took that whole operation apart, named names, how it went, who started it, and why it was named, and some of the other things that go with it. So I really break that down later on in the book with what Operation Paperclip was, how it worked, and who came over on it, and what it really meant. Basically, it just completely bypassed the immigration of this country. They just said, screw you, these guys are coming in, these are Nazi war criminals, some of them were tried at Nuremberg and dismissed, and they're here now. There's about 1,000 of them that came over.
Wow.
It didn't matter what they did. It did not matter what they did.
That's amazing.
Werner von Braun was a top SS agent, okay? Top, at the top.
He was?
He had more Jewish people working for him at Pina Mundi that died. They starved to death under his watch.
Oh, my God.
Many. Oh, thousands. They figured how long they could, and they used to urinate in the rockets, the V-2s, the Jewish people with the workers, the slaves, so they could possibly make these things fail. They were caught doing that. They were hung in the passageways, in the hallways, where they worked so the other workers could see them, and they were hung and left there for a month. So you imagine what that smelled like.
I can't imagine.
Yeah. So I found myself working for several scientists that were formerly part of the Nazi Third Reich and had been in blah, blah, blah. Werner von Braun was the main director, but his henchmen, all from Germany, were the ones, Werner von Lassberg, being one of his henchmen, being the chief instigator, that they behave like the Gestapo at NASA. They literally run it like a Gestapo.
Wow.
Anybody that they could get in trouble, they got them in trouble, and anybody that could get in trouble enough they would look to try to get people to commit, accuse them of treason and espionage. So if you complained to somebody else and you got on their crap list, they would try to set you up for espionage or treason because of the projects we were working on. That's the heat that I worked on when I was a young guy, like 21 years old.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, these guys were just like the Gestapo, and they got people in trouble. I fought back, and I knew how, but a lot of those people got thrown out, and some of them could probably put in jail for doing nothing.
Wow.
Yeah. That's how it ran at Rockwell, so you know.
That's
once again, mind control tactics and no individual thinking
that
towards the project that we were assigned to. This is when I really started to see this mind control because of their control. All they wanted us to do was go out and work on the spacecraft, which is called the Bird, and pay no attention, not worry about anything but what they said to do. And if you didn't like what they said to do, well, then they try to set you up. It was terrible, you know.
Wow.
And we were working 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. A year straight, we get Christmas or Thanksgiving off. You could take your choice. You know, that's how much we worked. So obviously, everybody faked being sick so they could be out for a day or two once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I used to work, you'd work from noon till midnight, and that's one shift. And if you wanted to take a vacation, you'd work from midnight to noon, you know, and then you'd reverse your shift. That was a vacation, the switch of shifts.
Mm-hmm.
You try it for 2 years. I was about 18 months. I did that.
Right.
I got sick. That's when I was smoking two packs of cigarettes a day because I didn't know what else to do. I was going crazy. As soon as I left that job, I quit smoking.
Wow.
But a lot of guys, you smoked and drank coffee. I was in terrible health. Skinny as a rail. If anyone appeared to get out of hand, they were threatened with breaching national security and some form of mental confinement. Once again, the mental confinement was there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize it at the time, but later on, learned a lot of this. A lot of these dictates came from a German company called IG Farben.
Yep.
When I left NASA, I went out into the civilian sector as a consultant for many different types of scientific, medical, chemical, and engineering projects.
Mm-hmm.
The next decade, until I started Pyridine, the company I have now, I visited over 2,000 different companies. During these visits, I had many eye-opening experiences. For example, when I visited Hughes Aircraft Company in El Segundo, just where we worked 2 weeks ago, each different department was working on an overall classified objective. Although the need-to-know rule was in place in companies like this, whereby one department did not completely understand what the other was doing, mm-hmm. because they were all my clients, I was consulting on their project, I got to see the big picture.
Mm-hmm.
But even seeing the big picture, I had to keep my mouth shut of what the big picture was between the different departments. So I could only hint at what the other guys were doing and then help them, you know, work better together. That's why I did well doing that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But once again, it was, you can't screw up at this. It's national security, and treason is a death sentence, you know.
Wow.
Now, all of the, all of you new listeners, there's a heck of a lot of listeners and watchers now from Ustream. You guys can go over to bbsradio.com and look in the personal history, and I have put in there several hundred of the companies that I called on from my actual notes of when that time took
mm-hmm.
place, like
mm-hmm.
in IBM, I'll have listed
mm-hmm.
department heads, this guy's in this engineering department,
mm-hmm.
and then they do
mm-hmm.
this, and this engineering department does this, and blah, blah,
mm-hmm.
blah, and that's all documented. Plus, when I worked at Lockheed Skunk Works, when I resigned, I had to turn in a clearance from there.
Right.
I still had another clearance, but with them. And I had to sign off from Lockheed Skunk Works, which was started by Kelly Johnson in the early 60s. And he was one who went out and did Area 51, which I cover in my book, with a U-2 for a place to land. All the documents are there. You can see them yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to worry that I'm making this up. It's all documented. A lot of people didn't believe with all the things I did. I don't care. It's all documented. It's all on the internet now.
Right.
So anyhow, I'm just seeing where I'm at here. Of course, at the time, I had to keep my observations to myself as I too still maintain a secret clearance, and to reiterate one department's work to another, even though it's the same company, would have been considered a severe national security breach.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But because I visited so many companies, I was able to get a true national picture of the leading edge of all classified discoveries and experiments being conducted at the time.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite place in all those days was Los Alamos, Site
mm-hmm.
Y, and Sandia Labs. We call it Site Y, both located near Albuquerque, New Mexico. I love Los Alamos.
Mm-hmm.
I used to play up there with stuff beyond belief.
Mm-hmm.
This I have well documented, including all the related documents of the military and civilian companies I work with, and blah, 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 radio,
mm-hmm.
archives,
mm-hmm.
BBS.
Mm-hmm.
In 1976, when I started Pyridine, I began lecturing on what I have learned and saw in the future would come a day when the entire world would fall upon some form of one-world governmental control.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I saw this. I mean, I was seeing the technology. We did, at Autonetics, we did the ILAS.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
ILAS today is called Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
I helped build the 1 billion watt rare earth lasers at the time. Now we use what's called a plasma system, which is different, and I've got pictures of that in action on BBS radio, the actual Army firing one of these things at a
mm-hmm.
missile and blowing it out of the sky.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually worked on that project. So anyway, I proceeded to get a PhD in homeopathic medicine so I could round out my knowledge. In other words, I wanted to learn how the body worked in conjunction to science, because I knew that every scientific discovery out there dovetail to some internal body function, because I found that the human psyche cannot conceive of anything outside the realm of what it's physically put together with.
Mm.
Anyway, afterwards I began to develop an anti-ELF devices and market them worldwide. As I began to study the effects of ELF, which, by the way, means extremely low-frequency electrical transmissions that violate internal human organelle electrical balances, I noticed that a large part of the American public was being given mind control drugs to calm them down. Really upsetting and creating stresses on them. So it was upsetting and creating stresses on them was the ELF their bodies were exposed to on a daily basis. Along with ELF, I found the man-made radiation from over 900 nuclear bomb tests was contaminated the drinking world water worldwide. This, of course, was causing the spread of cancer, breast in women, prostate in men at an alarming rate, and I cover that more later. Then I directed my studies towards cancer research and quickly found out that there were several very well-documented cures of cancer, but the pharmaceutical and medical societies did not want the news of a cure out to the general public. So when I began to see how this information is inaugurated, this is how I began to see an information was inaugurated into a society. I saw many people, often very qualified doctors, harassed and imprisoned. Several of them I saw imprisoned for curing cancer, medical doctors, and other diseases without using pharmaceuticals. I was just like blown away. By now, I have been able to market my devices into several clinics and universities worldwide. I began a worldwide lecture tour soon thereafter, and today I continue to do so. Okay, now let's look at some history here. I became involved when I began to work in a clinic in Newport Beach in 1979 with Dr. Gary Couture, where I found out that the greatest amount of drug prescribed at that time was Valium, and that the victim was the American housewife. I began to look at a darker side of the drug industry at this point, and I was astounded at what I found to be the cold heart of a hidden financial empire whose motive was to control the populace of the world. I just was blown away. I had no idea. Here I thought drugs were good, you know. I had just gotten my PhD, or was getting it at the time. I hadn't gotten it yet. And I thought drugs were good. I didn't know any better. You know, I was a biochemist, but I didn't study pharmaceuticals. You know, I studied chemistry. Now I was learning the real truth about mind control. Okay, the curtain rises in the 20th century. Okay, now let me see where we're at with this. Okay. Several of the current drug companies today have their roots from a company called IG Farben. IG translates into Interessen Gemeinschaft, or i.e. American Community of Interest. At the beginning of the 20th century, three major firms, BASF, and by the way, BASF is still around today. BASF, you'll see it on all CDs and tapes. BASF. Bayer, of course, Bayer made all kinds of aspirin, but they also made nerve gas chemicals. Horsch, or actually Hoche. All German companies dominated the world chemistry. These companies all originally started out making industry synthetic dyes. Now, this is back at the turn of the century when a lot of these guys started doing that. All three major firms also integrated into the production of essential raw materials, and then they began into the areas of chemistry, such as pharmaceuticals, photographic film, agriculture chemicals, and electrochemicals. The chairman of Bayer, the world's largest manufacturer of aspirin, Carl Duisberg, came to the United States in the spring of 1903. This is where it really starts to get its roots. There he visited several American trusts, such as Standard Oil, U.S. Steel, International Paper, and Alcoa, the famous aluminum house. After returning to Germany, he proposed a nationwide merger of pharmaceuticals and dye technologies with American interests. So they were really getting in bed now, the Americans.
Right.
So then between 1927... in the beginning of World War II, IG Farben doubled in size, doing great. Now, then IG Farben, which, you know, in Nuremberg trials, we'll get right there in a minute, doubled in size because, in great part to American assistance by bond issues, such as one for $30 million offered by the National City Bank. By 1939, when Hitler's taken power now, IG Farben acquired a participation of managerial influence in some 380 German firms and 500 foreign firms.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the biggest merger acquisitions in the world, okay?
Mm-hmm.
If you look around today, you will see the same thing happening all over again as the one world government marches the United States towards fascism. Large companies are buying out small ones by the dozens, and that's going on. And these companies don't need bailing out. Standard Oil, you don't see them bailing out. Any of these oil companies, nobody's bailing them out because they don't need bailing out.
Right.
They should let everybody needs bailing out not get bailed out and go by the wayside so we have new American young workers come and start new companies and get rid of this old heavyweight stuff that we have here.
Mm-hmm.
There are 2,000 cartel agreements between, there were 2,000 cartel agreements between IG Farben and foreign firms, including Standard Oil of New Jersey, DuPont, Alcoa, Dow Chemical, and others in the United States, the biggest ones in the world. In the beginning of Hitler's rise to power, IG Farben contributed 400,000 Reichsmarks to Hitler's political slush fund, which today that would be probably about $16 million. In 1928, the American holdings of IG Farben, the Bayer Company, General Aniline Works, AFCA, which you see AFCA printers all over in the print shops, Ansco, and the Winthrop Chemical Company, were organized into a Swiss holding company, G. Chemique, C-H-E-M-I-K. In the following year, these American firms became the first American IG Chemical Corporation, later renamed in this country General Aniline and Film. Hermann Schmitz now became president of the American IG, and during the war, Hermann's brother, Dietrich A. Schmitz, became the first American president of IG, and Hermann Schmitz is the guy that started it. I put that up a little bit higher up.
Right.
I did. I said that he founded IG Farben on December 25th, 1925, Hermann Schmitz. Okay. In 1929, Ivy Lee... This is real interesting. Firm of Ivy Lee and T.J. Ross became the public relations counsel for IG Farben in the United States before the war. Previous to that, Mr. Lee had been Rockefeller's public relations manager. Isn't that a little strange? Some of the directors of both American and German IG Farben empire were from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Okay, that was Charles Mitchell from the Federal Reserve Bank, which you see... Remember they just gave away $365 billion and they wouldn't say where it went?
Yep.
Hello? What's changed? Nothing. Okay. Walter Teagle, Paul M. Warburg from Ford Company. Motor Company was Edsel B. Ford. No wonder Edsels were a flop, you know.
Yeah.
Carl Bosch, and from the Bank of Manhattan, now called the Chase Manhattan Bank, that's probably your bank, was M.A. Metz and Paul Warburg, and from Standard Oil, New Jersey, Walter Teagle.
Amazing.
It's fair to say that Edsel Ford resigned after the war because of the political unhealthiness.
Yeah.
Of course, some of the karma was passed down to the Ford Motor Company with the ever unpopular Edsel.
Yeah.
Henry Ford and my dad were around then, and they wouldn't get near. They wouldn't get near IG Farben.
Wow.
Yeah. Now currently looking at our present day situation, the same Federal Reserve Bank that supported the Nazi IG Farben won't account for a lot of the money authorized for them to bail out several American banks, their industrial compounds. This fact should be duly noted as a major part of the inside track. Yeah.
Yeah.
During the planning of the invasion of Czechoslovakia and Poland and World War II, IG Farben dictated and directed the Nazi officials with chemical plants, which chemical plants should be secured and delivered to IG Farben. During this time, John D. Rockefeller's United States-based company, Standard Oil, had formed a cartel with IG Farben. Even today, IG Farben is not the largest company that it was, it has been diversified into several other companies, and the original name dropped.
Yeah,
look how big businesses were then in those days, so corrupted. Just as large business today.
It's going to be pretty corrupted, I would think.
Yeah. IC Farben built a factory named the Buena Napuna Chemical Plant for producing synthetic oil and rubber from coal in Auschwitz.
Oh, boy.
Beginning of the SS, which is Schutzstaffel, Hitler's private guard, Praetorian Guard. Hitler's private Praetorian Guard, which was the SS, was an idea derived, by the way, from the guards used by the Roman Empire. So he wasn't even original with that. That activity in the camps in this location during the Holocaust. At the peak of 1944, this factory made use of 83,000 slave laborers. One of the products manufactured by the time that IG Farben was pesticide Zycon B, which was used in the German Reich gas chambers.
Right. Now, was that made by IG Farben, or was that made by...
that was. And also, Mercedes-Benz, I think, actually made the gas chambers.
Was it the gas chambers? I know BMW was involved there.
They all three were. Yeah,
they all were.
A Bavarian Motor Works.
Yeah.
Yeah, they all three were.
Yeah.
And I get into it more. Now, check this out. During a meeting, Heinrich Himmler, the chief of the SS, everybody knows who he is, a chicken farmer, was the main director of the building of Auschwitz. Himmler delegated SS Major Karl Wolf, chief of his personal staff, to be liaison officer between the SS and IG Farben.
Right.
During a meeting with Heinrich Luschisch, manager of IG Farben's Auschwitz concentration camp gasoline plant, it was determined that IG Farben would pay the SS 3 Reichsmarks for each unskilled concentration camp inmate and 3 Reichsmarks for skilled inmates. Later, as the war progressed, the SS agreed to furnish children at 1.5 Reichsmarks per day. And, of course, the inmates received nothing and barely enough food and water to sustain themselves. Now, I'm just about out of time here. At the end of the war, due to the severity of the war crimes committed by IG Farben, the company was so corrupt it could not be allowed to exist any longer. It was divided between the United States and Russia. During the Nuremberg trials, a United States military tribunal, 24 directors of the IB Farben were indicted. 13 were sentenced to prison terms between 1 and 8 years. Some of those indicted in the trial were subsequently made leaders of many post-war companies. Two-thirds of the 6 companies that owned IG Farben are still business today. They are Bayer, Bassett, Afka, and Hoechst.
That's amazing.
If you look carefully, you will see their products of these companies everywhere. Now, that's all I'm going to do on this today. Next week, we'll start off with a brief psychological interlude leading into mind control.
During WW2, when we went over there, I believe we were instructed not to bomb some of those prescription companies.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
I'd say that's what I heard.
No, we were definitely, not to do that. Definitely those instructions were there. Because remember, it was Rockefeller. Remember, Max Warburg and his brother, one Warburg is on the Federal Reserve Bank and the Council for Rockefeller, and the other one's over there his brother is running IG Farben, one of the operators.
Right.
At the Federal Reserve Board of the United States of America, and Chase Manhattan Bank, which was called Chase Bank then, supporting and giving money to Hitler during
the
war.
That's amazing.
And when the war ended, these companies said, it's in the book later, we'll get to it, but their comment was, why did you keep funding this during the war when they're our enemy? And they said, well, we were only funding the psychological research part of it.
Wow.
That was their cop-out to the whole thing.
Yeah.
Pretty interesting, huh?
Yeah, it's amazing what we did.
It hasn't changed any. It's when you realize, I'm bringing this book and the events right up to the day I release the book to publication. It'll be that current.
With all of the names,
the paper trail, stuff that people won't believe completely. If you know how to do your due diligence, you'll be able to find out for yourself a lot of the things I even left out.
You know what's interesting is that Wernher von Braun didn't even like the United States.
He hated it.
He hated it.
Yeah.
It's just... how they let somebody like that in this country is absolutely amazing.
Well, Stephen Averbaugh, my friend, worked for Wernher von Braun in Africa on the satellites they were launching down there because they were on the equator.
Mm-hmm.
Forget the name of the company. He told me what it was, but Wernher von Braun, it was one of his companies. He was all over the place. Yeah.
Amazing.
So anyway, we're out of time.
Okay, buddy.
You know.
That was a great show.
Yeah, we always have fun here, don't we?
Yes, we do.
So we got to let Holly Penfield start, you know, bringing up the music here. You've been listening to Dr. Fred Bell's Health Science and Energy Show. There's a huge volume of listeners I see from Ustream. Huge volume. And I thank you guys for joining in here. And Bella Bird and myself and Steve Barish wish you a good weekend.
Thank you.
And we'll be hanging out next week. See you then, next Friday for
Take
some
care.
More of this stuff. You're going to get in trouble over the weekend, Steve?
Oh, always.
Starting to rain in here. I don't know why, but I feel a little rain coming down here. You know how it goes. Bella,
yeah.
You feel the rain?
Yep.
She doesn't really feel it. She's got a, kind of an oily, feathery skin here, you know?
Mm.
Well, this was a lot of fun. So until next week, have a great week. Check my website, www.pyridine.com. Check Dr. Fred Bell out in the search engine, see what kind of trouble he gets in. Check out Steve Barish. What's your show tomorrow, by the way?
Steve Barish Healing Hour. It's on at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 3 p.m. Pacific Time.
Yeah, it's 3 p.m. Pacific at bbsradio.com. You new Ustream guys, get over there. And also, Steve, you need to get on Ustream.
Yes, I do.
It's a big group out here now. It's getting huge. It's double what it was last week.
That's cool.
And that's the end of the broadcast from Jurassic Space Park.
Wonderful.
Good night.